Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda.
I think it would be fair to say, and I've written about this in the past, in the shift from, if you like, 19th century economics to 20th century economics, something very remarkable happened, quite surprising in a way, though I understand why it happened, which is that land, which was the economist's shorthand for all resources as a factor of economic production, disappeared from the models. In moving from classical economics to neoclassical economics, which is the contemporary frame for most economic analysis. It's a sort of the orthodox starting point. Land dropped out of the analysis, and it came to be assumed that the right way of thinking about the world is one of essentially constant returns to scale, with the only relevant factors of production being capital and labor. And ideas, technical progress. One way of thinking about this will be to say, well, we should compute the negative outputs of every activity in society. That's clearly going to be an immense task. It could be done in a rough and ready way, but it wouldn't solve any problem. The better way to go about this is to introduce regulations and or taxes which force the decision makers to internalize that cost and in the process more or less eliminate the negative externality. So that's the first best policy, and if you pursue that policy ruthlessly and rigorously, a very large number of negative externalities can be eliminated.
I'm very pleased today to introduce Martin Wolf. Martin is an associate editor and chief economics commentator at the Financial Times. He's a distinguished and highly respected financial and economic journalist and commentator, covering a very wide range of economic, financial and other topics, and he has recently been a strong voice on the importance of dealing with climate change. Martin's most recent publications are Why Globalization Works and The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Have Still to Learn from the Financial Crisis, published in 2015. Thank you very much, Martin, for taking the time today to speak to the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
It's a pleasure.
And I'm very much looking forward to talking to you about sustainability and about the role of sustainability in economics and our current economic system and how well it works, do you think, when it comes to issues around sustainable development and issues around sustainability more generally? And I guess that's a pretty good place to start. To what extent do you think that the contemporary economic models deals with sustainability issues? Does it do a good job, or to what extent does sustainability and ideas of ecology and environment be included in the model?
Well, I should say first of all that I don't regard myself as an expert in all the work being done by economists and others in the areas of including resources broadly defined, above all natural resources, in economic models. So I know a tremendous amount of work in this area, and since I cover so much, given by the nature of my job, I can't possibly claim to be up with all of it. I think it would be fair to say, and I've written about this in the past, in the shift from, if you like, 19th century economics to 20th century economics, something very remarkable happened, quite surprising in a way, though I understand why it happened, which is that land, which was the economist's shorthand for all resources as a factor of economic production, disappeared from the models. In moving from classical economics to neoclassical economics, which is the contemporary frame for most economic analysis. It's a sort of the orthodox starting point. Land dropped out of the analysis, and it came to be assumed that the right way of thinking about the world is one of essentially constant returns to scale, with the only relevant factors of production being capital and labor and ideas, technical progress. And land disappeared altogether. And I think the main reason for that was that in analyzing the growth of economies, it didn't appear that diminishing returns were very important. And it appeared that capital in the modern industrial sector was the dominant driver, capital and ideas. So since all economics, indeed all science, rests on simplifying models, you have to simplify to get any understanding of very complex phenomena. This was essentially dropped out of economics. And that then was reinforced in the 30s and 40s when modern national accounting was developed. And it's worth remembering it was developed essentially for war, in order to facilitate the mobilization of resources in the Great War of the Second World War. And it was an attempt to work out what resources were at the disposal of governments in order to fight this war. And what was relevant there again was what could be produced and used out of production. So for these reasons, fundamental reasons, resources, including everything to do with the environment, disappeared from the economic models and they disappeared from national accounts. Now, there have been attempts to put them back in since then, but it is fair to say that in standard accounting frameworks that we still use, GDP, and in standard growth models, these are still largely ignored. Partly because they're very difficult to measure with any degree of precision, they're very difficult to value. There are lots of other things that are also ignored from GDP. All household work is ignored, for example. So lots of things are ignored. But these are very, very important areas. And people, I think, are just not quite clear how to put them into the accounting. And in the models, equally, they're really very difficult to put in because once you start engaging with many, many factors of production, working out what's going on becomes really very complicated. So the result is that these things have been ignored. And finally, I think one has to allow for the fact that by and large, economists until relatively recently, last 10 years, 15 years at most, few 20 years, have just not thought these were very important factors. One could treat the economy as if it was a subsystem of the global. Entire global system, which didn't really interact with the rest of the world very much. And we now realize that isn't right, but it's difficult to know exactly what to do about it.
Right. That's very interesting. Because as you mentioned, some of the factors that aren't included are very important from a sustainability perspective in terms of the natural capital, I guess social capital as well, and degradation of the environment and pollution. So I was wondering, to what extent does it matter, or how does that play out? Because you see every day, people really the economies release figures on GDP figures and GDP growth, and it's quite closely watched, and it's an important variable. And I know in business they talk about what you measure and the impact that what you measure that you control, or the impact that that has. I don't know whether you have any thoughts on that.
There are so many different areas here. There are sort of simple, trivial answers, and then there are really deep problems. I mean, for quite a lot of environmental effects, which you can regard as local and in some sense internalizable, economists tend to talk about externalities and the obverse of an externality is sort of, I think, a word that's almost never used, an internality. So, but economists tend to say, well, you can internalize externalities. So, to give you an example, a fairly classic sort of example, you have a factory which is belching out smoke. The smoke is an output of the factory of negative value. Clearly, it does people damage. And therefore, the true output of this factory is whatever product it produces and the value people put on that, minus the cost of the smoke that it's emitting to the atmosphere, to people, and to other things one might care about, life, wildlife, for example. So one way of thinking about this will be to say, well, we should compute the negative outputs of every activity in society. That's clearly going to be an immense task. It could be done in a rough and ready way, but it wouldn't solve any problem. The better way to go about this is to introduce regulations and or taxes, which force the decision makers to internalize that cost and, in the process, more or less eliminate the negative externality. So that's the first best policy. And if you pursue that policy ruthlessly and rigorously, a very large number of negative externalities can be emitted, can be eliminated. So certainly in terms of local pollution, if you like, the quality of water, the quality of rivers, the quality of the atmosphere. In most advanced countries, in fact, all advanced countries, these have massively improved in the course of my own lifetime. I'm nearly 70, so I've seen it. I live in London, and London, from an environmental point of view, is immensely better than it was, despite all the car fumes, than it was when I was a child. Now, so the best thing to do is to deal with that. If you deal with that effectively, then a lot of the negative externalities that you'd want to measure disappear. Not all of them, by any means, but a lot of them will disappear. The big things, I think, that leaves two, at least two huge things which are emitted. The first tend to be the global externalities, of which the climate is surely the most important. I tend to think that the other one, not I tend to think, obviously the other one is the oceans. These are the atmosphere and the oceans are unowned natural resources, and they're used as free dumping sites by humanity, and therefore those effects are ignored in our accounts completely, and we have not succeeded in internalizing these externalities. The first best policy is still clearly to do that. And if we did do that well and effectively, then the problem of having failed to measure things correctly would at least diminish. The second big one you mentioned is the consumption of natural resources. This is in the production process itself, directly in the production process. You could argue that CO2 emissions are a sort of example of that, but I'm going to put that to one side. I'm thinking more of things like oil, coal, trees, and all the rest of it. Now, some of the right way here, I think it is actually relatively easy to see what the accounting process should be, what it would look like. You would actually have to distinguish between the resource costs of actually getting the exploring, finding, extracting this stuff. That's measured in GDP anyway, and should be. That's, I think, at least conceptually, relatively straightforward. But you have to distinguish that from the finite natural resource itself, the natural capital itself, and that should not be part of GDP. It should be seen as an asset transaction. Now, for most economies, this is not a hugely important issue because what you might call natural resource rents aren't of that kind, are not an enormous part of the output of those economies. But there are quite a number of economies, all the oil-producing countries, Norway, other natural resource providing producing countries, which are essentially extracting a finite resource. The GDP is clearly hugely overestimated for these countries because a large part of that GDP is just simply taking a scarce resource out of the ground, and if they don't replace it with some other form of capital on which they can live after the resource disappears, it will turn out the GDP is, in a very clear and straightforward sense, unsustainable. It will cease to last. And the right way to do that, in my view, and the Norwegians are closest to this, they do this in a relatively sensible way in practice, is to treat the value of the natural resource itself as it comes out of the ground as a form of capital. And that part of the output should not be seen as part of GDP at all. And that's generally true of any part of GDP which is unsustainable, in the sense that it cannot continue indefinitely. You're running down a natural resource. There's an argument that quite a big part of Chinese GDP has had that characteristic. If we properly measured the consumption of natural resources in China, GDP growth will be considerably smaller than it showed. And here I think conceptually what you need to do is relatively clear. It's been in practice not done, and I've been a bit surprised by that.
Right. That's interesting. So rainforests, water resources, things like that, they would be included in what you're talking about there, from the more of a balance sheet approach.
Rainforests certainly, because they clearly aren't reproducible. Finite water resources, aquifers, for example, I think relatively straightforward. Some water resources are renewable in the sense, you know, that pretty obviously rivers are replenished. Using up the water at a faster rate than it is replenished would have to be regarded as you indicate, as a form of capital decumulation. This is generally, I mean, this is obviously the point. It's a variant, not such an extreme variant as an absolutely finite resource. It's not an absolutely finite resource, since the water system at the global level is obviously recycled at all, is consistently recycled. But of course, you can end up using water faster than it is replenished, and that should, of course, be allowed for. And then in some parts of the world, it's obvious that that is indeed what is happening.
Right. That's very interesting. I'm just wondering about what impact you think the state of development of these ideas has on COP21 and the Sustainable Development Goals. To what extent do you think that, does it matter that these measures are not fully implemented, and some are more conceptual than others? And I'm just wondering what you think would need to happen to you know, facilitate, I suppose, this move to a more sustainable economy and the goals that these different agreements have set out.
I think one of the big questions, which I've already touched upon with my discussion of internalizing externalities vis-a-vis getting the GDP accounts perfect, that I'm fully prepared to, this is a distinction I make, I'm fully prepared to accept that if we had better accounting mechanisms, we would better understand what we are doing to the environment. And above all, we would understand better the extent to which our standard of living is sustainable. But making, as it were, the GDP accounts in this sense more fully comprehensive, so they include everything that bears on human welfare, which is in theory what we might be trying to do. Some might even argue we should go beyond human welfare, but let's leave that for the moment. That will be an improvement, but it should be understood that when we do that, we would end up in huge number of very, very complicated and difficult valuation questions, which we could probably get bogged down with for many, many years without producing accounts everybody's very happy with. And that's, I think, one of the reasons, at least one, there are other reasons why we haven't moved in any systematic, globally agreed way to environmentally inclusive accounts. So my, I have a little bit of a view. I don't want to push this too far. That going for the perfect accounting of everything is a little bit of a snare and a delusion, in the sense that we could end up pursuing that particular snark, as we hunt that particular snark, for a very, very long time without improving actual decision making. So the way I like to think about these systems we're trying to deal with, these challenges we're trying to deal with, is that we should treat the global externalities the way we have treated local externalities, which I've already discussed. It's obviously much more complicated to deal with global externalities, particularly global externalities which operate over an immensely long time period, like climate. So these are most, in orders of magnitude, the most complex externalities we will ever have to deal with. But I think the core thing here to do is not to spend immense amounts of time and effort worrying about measurement, but working out a system to internalize the externalities, i.e. to get rid of the problem so far as we can by eliminating the growth, the CO2 emissions. And that's the challenge. That is the challenge that we have. Now, my view is that the right way of doing that, obviously, is through international agreements which proceed to internalize externalities and to develop technologies and progress and further develop technologies which will allow us to eliminate CO2 emissions or bring them back into balance with the absorptive capacity of the global system, the biosphere. That's clearly the actual challenge. And if we measured things perfectly or not, wouldn't solve the problem. I would say COP21 is the right way to go in principle, but it actually hasn't made enough of a difference. The right way to go in principle because it's global and the solution has to be global. It requires everybody to do their part, every government. It requires government action because this is something that is external to the market. It requires government actions, and those governments have to coordinate and cooperate. The problem, obviously, is that because it's such a huge global problem, because we haven't yet agreed on the technical means and the technical and organizational means of solving it, the agreements we've reached so far, and I think COP21 falls into that category, are not adequate to deal with the problem. So the danger is that people will think COP21 was, as it were, the end, instead of being at the most the end of the beginning. My own view in my evaluation of COP21 is that it was a fairly pragmatic way of dealing with the challenges in front of us, given that the first best mechanisms were not available, which would have been a global carbon price and a path for the global carbon price. Since those first bests were not available, this was a reasonable second best, but it's not going to be enough. And it's clear that climate is becoming increasingly destabilized. And I am concerned that the result will be a global failure. But I think it's the right way to go, and it's the right priority. Meantime, I think the science and technology, the science and economics approach has to be to look at what's happening at the climate system itself, rather than incorporating the whole of national accounts, working out what the costs are, and working out what the best policy instruments are for dealing with it. And dealing with it in a specialized global framework of this kind. I believe very strongly that the best way to do global governance, since we're not going to have a global government, is to have a series of very specific, targeted, well-organized treaty frameworks which bind governments in particular areas, as we did with the Montreal Protocol. That seems to me to be the way to make this work. So I think that the COP21 is a step, but a small step in, broadly speaking, the right direction.
Right, that's very interesting. And you mentioned the carbon tax there. Do you have thoughts on that? I mean, some people were disappointed that there wasn't more about that in COP21. Others were pursuing a more pragmatic line and saying that that wasn't, that would have been too much to expect?
Well, the decision in the end was made that for practical reasons, it was impossible to agree a global framework, either cap and trade or taxes. This is for pragmatic reasons, which we could discuss if you like. I'm pretty strongly on the tax side rather than cap and trade. But if you could make cap and trade work, I wouldn't have any problem with it. I mean, this is just a matter of pragmatism. The objectives are essentially the same. The problem was that after, what is it, 24 years after, or 23 years after Kyoto, it became pretty obvious that the world was not going to agree a tax or cap and trade system. There are a whole host of reasons for this, which all ultimately come down to the fact that all global decisions are made by 200 governments. The governments all have different interests. They respond to different constituents. They're suspicious of one another. Some of them deny the science altogether. So getting a global agreement, which is obviously which is what we would have if we had a global government, we would have a carbon price, and that would be the optimal outcome. It's not feasible. So the decision was made that we should instead have national plans, nationally decided plans, and each would commit themselves to certain targets in terms of CO2 emissions. Each would seek it in their own way within that framework. And the idea is that those targets will be progressively tightened. We already know that the targets they committed themselves to, if you add them up, are not sufficient to bring to stop the global temperature rising from the pre-industrial level by more than 2 degrees. I've been told that it would grow, even if they deliver their targets, which is very implausible, it would be at least a 3.5 degree rise. So the schemes, their plans are clearly inadequate, grossly inadequate. There's no doubt about that. But the idea was, well, let's start with that. Let's see how they can do with that. Let's tighten it up. And maybe as these things develop, each individual country will start developing a pricing system because it's one of the ways to do it for them. And then they will see, well, look, we're paying a higher price than somebody next door. There's a possibility of trading our allowances. And then we start moving in that way towards a global system by locking together national plans. Will that happen? I have no idea. But so as I said already before, COP21 seems to me clearly, as it were, like the famous remark by Winston Churchill about democracy, it's the worst possible solution except all the others that we couldn't actually agree on. So we couldn't agree on the others, so this is the least bad solution available. But it's clearly very, very imperfect arrangement for dealing with this problem.
Right, that's very interesting. I'm just wondering whether one more question, which is probably one we could talk about for many hours as well, and it's to do with the importance of growth in an economic system. And I think some people have said that the idea of sustainable development is an oxymoron, and that growth is the problem. How important is growth to economics, and can one envisage an economic system that wasn't based on growth in the way it is today?
I think that's a very profound question. Well, first of all, it's obviously possible to imagine an economic system that doesn't include growth. To all intents and purposes, this is a slight exaggeration, but between, let's say, the time of the agricultural revolution, let's say about 10,000 years ago, and about 1800, the world economy grew only with population. Real incomes per head, this isn't quite right. There certainly were improvements, but broadly speaking, the vast majority of people lived on the subsistence level. And real GDP per head, which is, I think, really what we mean by growth, not just increasing the absolute size of the economy because there are more people, though that's part of it, but basically rising GDP per head didn't exist. So it's perfectly possible to have economic systems that don't generate growth. We've been there, done that for thousands of years. One might even say even further back, hundred thousand years. So of course we can. That's point one. Point two, we have discovered that if you have an economic system which is based on initiative by individuals and organizations like companies to innovate and develop new products, develop more efficient ways of producing old products and offering them to customers, the businesses and entities that do that tend to outcompete the ones that don't, and that generates growth. I mean, that's how it happens. And of course, one of the ways the innovation occurs is in the use of natural resources, fossil fuels. We've already talked about that. But to have an economic system that doesn't generate growth at all, you would have to stop. In essence, you'd have to stop the competitive process. And that's a pretty radical thing to do. I personally would oppose it because it seems to me to suppress something very valuable about human beings, their creativity, and their willingness and desire to compete with one another, because I think we, among other things, we are competitive, and the ability to develop and produce new products which we enjoy using is actually rather a good thing. So, but the point I'm making is a broader one, whether you agree with that or not. Preventing growth is not some trivial thing. It involves transforming the whole nature of our economic system back to something more like a feudal system. Back towards something much more hierarchically controlled, anti-competitive, and anti-individualistic, in my view. It's a really very profound value shift. You shouldn't think of growth as some horrible thing that comes from out there, which, if only we were nice people, we could stop. Growth is a byproduct, intimately connected to the individualistic and rationalistic post-enlightenment world. And for those of us like me who are very much enlightenment people, giving that up, giving those core values up in order to get rid of growth will be unbelievably unpleasant. And I would oppose it. And then the third reason I would suggest why, even if you don't accept the second rather deep point, don't accept the values, is, well, actually, there are lots and lots and lots of people in the world for whom growth, in the sense that we mean it, would actually transform lives.
Yes.
So, of course, look, I'm a very well-off person. If my income doesn't go up again anymore, I don't care. And it's probably true for at least many in the advanced world, though not all by any means, that they're reasonably comfortably off, and with the proper organization of our societies, we could ensure a reasonable standard of living for everybody, even if we didn't grow anymore. But that's clearly not true for the bulk of humanity. Roughly, maybe 40% of humanity lives at or near subsistence, not actually at subsistence. Sort of what the World Bank estimates at $2 a day in GDP per head at purchasing power parity or thereabout, but it's pretty close to subsistence. What does that mean? Often they don't feed themselves well, their children are malnourished, they don't have access to decent medical care, their life expectancies are shorter, their children die in infancy. They have limited means of entertainment, their communications are inadequate, they can't travel and enjoy the pleasures of travel, all the things that we in the developed world take for granted. Now, it seems to me that certainly we in the developed world, I certainly feel, I cannot possibly tell these people, well, that was fine, we had this growth, we're pretty well off, but you people, you can't really share this at all. I'm afraid there are too many of you and you really just have to disappear or starve or just remain poor forever. That's simply not on. That seems to be obviously an argument you couldn't possibly make. So if you were to stop growth and to try to stop growth, you would then, and this gets to the fourth point, you'd have to say, well, since people can't get better off in aggregate, we're going to have to redistribute it. We can't have a world economy in which some economies like UK or US or Ireland are maybe 20, 30 times as rich as other economies on a per capita basis. That can't be sustainable. That really is unfair. We would have to distribute, in a static world, resources and standard of living more evenly. And I tend to play a little game by this. The global average real income per head is about, I haven't done the most recent numbers, but it's about $8,000 a head measured at purchasing power parity. Just to give you a relative measure, in the US it's about 45,000. In the UK it's a little under 40, maybe 37, 38. So we're about five or six times the world average. So if we were going to be reduced to the world average in order that all the countries that are much poorer than the world average could be brought up to it, say in Africa, we would have to transfer our surplus, we would have to give up about 80% of our standard of living. And transfer it to the rest of the world, leaving aside the organization of that, the transfer problem, as economists call it. There is just no way on earth that could be done without the most extreme form of Stalinist tyranny. It's inconceivable that you could operate a no-growth world with a reasonable degree of equality without a degree of tyranny, which is itself, to my mind, ultimately unacceptable. So this no growth world is a pretty difficult thing to arrange. And then I would add the final point, which is sort of the Benjamin Friedman point. Benjamin Friedman is a professor at Harvard who's written a book on the moral virtues of growth. And this is where I come back to the internalizing externalities point, the way of trying to make growth work compatible with the environment. That's my view. But his basic point, and I've repeated this, is if you live in a society where standards of living on average are rising, of course, you need to shape it so it is sustainable, so it doesn't destroy the environment. And we can have a big debate about whether that's possible. But he's basically saying, the nice thing about a society like that is that it's positive sum. That is to say, you can make everybody better off. And you should be trying to make everybody better off. And in a society in which everybody is getting better off, it becomes relatively easy to solve distributional problems and is relatively easy to persuade people to be optimistic about the future. And indeed, one of the big problems in our developed world right now, it seems to me, is that we've stopped growing. We are actually close to zero growth societies. And one of the consequences, in my view, of being in a close to zero growth societies is somebody like Donald Trump. He's a reflection of the political misery of income stagnation or decline. So do not ignore the extent to which our relatively peaceful, relatively harmonious democratic societies, which have only existed for about a century or so in much of where they do exist, are themselves a byproduct of the growth miracle. So what I'm saying, I understand the concern. It's a perfectly legitimate concern about whether we can increase the standard of living of the human population while respecting natural constraints. I think that's a very profound question. But the value questions, the political questions that are raised, and the sort of social organization questions that are raised by trying to move to a zero growth economy worldwide, which is what it would have to be, not just in our countries, these are, in my view, incredibly huge and frightening challenges.
Well, it's interesting. You've covered a lot of ground there. And clearly, you know, talking about income growth or stagnation, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years, clearly the global economy has not delivered for whole sections of communities, as you mentioned, and given rise to populism. And I suppose the other side of the coin is the fact that, you know, the levels of consumption of resources in America, for example, and the developed world compared to the developing world is what worries some people to the extent that they feel that this is not sustainable and will ultimately lead to a world in which, you know, the poorer will bear the consequences. The people in developing countries, the people in parts of the world that are going to suffer the most egregious or terrible consequences of global warming. So, the idea of a no-growth model is one thing, but weaning ourselves off growth, which I guess is part of the idea that I was exploring there, is certainly an interesting one. And I suppose, you know, some of these arguments are theoretical as well, you know, the moral virtue of growth. But at a certain point, you do have to look at what's happening on the ground and say to what extent is that a model that's not actually, actually working, or a model that is actually flawed.
I think there are three ways of thinking about it. The first way would be the ultimate pessimistic view is that sort of Malthus was right, but for the wrong reasons. That is to say, he thought it was impossible to have consistent rises in standards of living, because his investigation of nature indicated to him that whenever there was abundance, procreation of the relevant species, sets of species, would increase, survival would increase, populations would increase, and ultimately this would lead to population collapses through famine and death. And he argued that essentially the same would happen to human beings, because as we got richer, we would have more children. And this didn't happen, as we now know. And instead, over 200 years, extraordinary, unprecedented, and really unimaginable rises in standards of living, and however you care to measure them, there isn't any real doubt about that, have occurred. So instead of the collapse occurring through population, the collapse can occur through, as you already indicated, unsustainable resource use. And in the end, the collapse will occur through, possibly in the end, huge weather-related catastrophes of some kind, and the economic system will founder. Now, my own impression of the evidence on this is that that isn't likely to be the case, but it's clearly possible. It's clearly at least possible that we are going into collapse mode. And therefore the system isn't sustainable, and that's the end of it. And if it's not sustainable, it won't be sustained. A second point of view would be that actually human beings are extraordinarily adaptable, and we have achieved an extraordinary progress in our scientific and technological understanding. There isn't much doubt about that compared with 300 years ago, and that we will be able to find ways, some of them possibly quite unpleasant, of adjusting and coping with these natural challenges that we will confront over the next century, including climate. And we will go on. We might have to move a lot, but we will go on. That's sort of the is it sustainable or not question. So that's one sort of possible way of thinking, it's all going to end very badly or not. I don't know. Since I'm not, I don't think anybody knows, but I don't know whether we can avoid this Malthusian trap. Now, the second point is, which you already stressed, it is clearly true that the developed countries that got there first have used a disproportionate share of the world's resources and are continuing to use a disproportionate share of the world's resources on an annual basis. And whether that's sustainable, you can certainly argue it isn't just. And indeed, most people in developing countries do argue it isn't just. They say, why should we, for example, stop our emissions when you were as poor as we were, you were increasing your emissions in a crazy way and taking no account of the consequences. You eliminate your excess emissions and we'll go on doing what we want. And the answer to that is, my answer to that is, whatever you feel about the morality of that, it isn't going to happen for the reasons I've already outlined. And even if the developed countries did, in fact, reduce significantly their emissions, say, that's not going to solve the problem, because all the growth in emissions now is from developing and emerging countries. So they're going to have to be part of this. So the argument from justice doesn't get you very far in dealing with a pragmatic problem. I've already indicated to you, which is sort of my third point, that I don't think it is a conceivable policy for any democratically elected government, or indeed even any tyranny that I can imagine, that we're going to say to the people of the developed world, well, I'm sorry, it's not a, you don't have a sustainable life pattern, and as of now, your level of consumption is going to be cut by 70 or 80%. This government wouldn't last a minute. So I'm basically a pragmatic human being. I'm perfectly prepared to accept that this, and I've already discussed this already, might not turn out to be sustainable, but you have to do what you can. And doing what you can't doesn't strike me, has never struck me as a very sensible way to proceed. So I'm with those people. I know deeply that the people like me are regarded with vast suspicion, but people like me include people like Nick Stern, for example, who's obviously probably the world's leading economist looking at these issues, Nordhaus in Yale and so forth. He basically says, we're not going to be able to eliminate growth, and we're not going to be able to end the entire, everything that has been achieved since the Enlightenment. It's just not going to happen. What we are going to have to do is to do, as I've already said before, do for global externalities what we've successfully done for local ones. Of course, it's much more difficult. The challenges are enormous. But if we, instead of wasting our resources as we've done, really focused our scientific resources and technological resources on renewable energy in a really, you know, Manhattan Project style way, really worked hard to create a treaty-bound system with teeth, which gave incentives to scientists and businesses and technologists to transform the resource-using aspects of our system. If we transform the way our cities are configured, how transport systems work, and all the rest of it, particularly the new cities coming along, we could, over the next half century, move perhaps more soon, quickly, to a zero-carbon-emitting world. And without sacrificing all prospects for higher standards of living properly measured. And in practice, that's the only conceivable way to go. The only way, in my view, that we can solve the problems created by human ingenuity, human genius, really, human technology, is by relying on more human ingenuity and more human genius. The idea, in my judgment, that we can solve this problem by going back to, as it were, our version of the Garden of Eden, because that's what this is about, giving up all the products of our ingenuity and effort. It seems to me sort of, it's a constant theme of human history, wanting to go back to such a golden age, but it never was very golden for most of humanity, and we can't go back. That seems to me the core of what the Genesis story is telling us. We are curious. We are innovative, and we're going to have to innovate our way out of this. And if we can't innovate our way out of this, in practice, in my view, there will be no solution. I understand many people find this view that I have advanced despicable, immoral, maybe even amoral. But to me, it's the only moral thing to do is something that can work. And we have to make, we have to do something that can work by using the abilities of humanity in a better direction. They are huge questions. You asked, obviously, the most profound questions. And at least if you're interested in economics, social science, and the future of humanity.
Right. a very powerfully articulated credo. Are you optimistic, Martin, finally?
I find it temperamentally very difficult to be optimistic. My natural tendency is to be pessimistic. And that's probably partly because of my personal background. My parents were both refugees from Europe during the Hitler period. All their families were exterminated. So I have this sort of, to be honest, some sort of dark shadow. Things can go unbelievably wrong. And so I have that pessimism. And I also like to say one of the nice things about being a pessimist is that in my life, I've had so many pleasant surprises. I'm rarely disappointed because I hadn't expected much. But I'm often pleased because I hadn't expected things to go well. So there have been quite a lot of things that have happened to the world in my lifetime, which I regard with great pleasure. The collapse of the Soviet Union was one, the successful development of so many developing countries. What you say about how many of the world's poor are not benefiting is correct, but it is also true that there are parts of the world that I know moderately well. India is an example where there is still immense, colossal poverty. But there's no doubt if you go around India that it's people are much better off than they were 40 or 50 years ago. So things have progressed. And finally, despite my natural pessimism, I do feel that humanity has, as I've already said, despite all its immense flaws, its tribalism, its natural short-sightedness, its tendency towards hatred and hostility, it also has immense qualities, of which the most important are this ability to invent, innovate, and above all, the curiosity which allows us to try and understand the world. And our advances in that respect seem to me so extraordinary and so heartwarming. And they bring with them all increases in understanding, increases in our powers over the natural world, bring with them a tremendous challenges and dangers. But they also bring with them the opportunities to learn and to do better. And so I suppose I am optimistic fundamentally that at least we can, and possibly that we will, find those solutions. In any case, as I've already indicated, I don't think we can reject who we are. We are who we are, and we are going to solve the problems we create only by using the attributes we have used to create them.
Well, that's fascinating to talk to you, Martin, and to hear your views. It's been very stimulating. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to the Sustainability Agenda today.
That's certainly a very long 25 minutes.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.